Hi again, Medical Education Podcast listeners. This is Kevin Eva, the editor-in-chief of the journal. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with a colleague from Western University, which is near my old hometown in Ontario, the eastern half of Canada. His name is Faisal Haji, and he's chief resident in neurosurgery in the Department of Clinical Neurosciences and works with the Schulich School of Medicine at Western University. Thanks, Faisal, for making the time to chat.
My pleasure.
The paper that you have coming out in the September issue of Medical Education 2016 is called Thrive or Overload? The Effect of Task Complexity on Novices Simulation-Based Learning. I know this was done as part of graduate work for you or fellowship through the Wilson Center at the University of Toronto. Do you mind giving our listeners a sense of why you're interested in this topic in the first place?
Sure. So yeah, as you mentioned, Kevin, this was done as a part of my PhD dissertation. I started that in 2011 at the University of Toronto through the Institute of Medical Sciences. At the same time, I was doing a fellowship at the Wilson Center for Research and Education at Toronto General Hospital. And I was also doing a fellowship at the SickKids Learning Institute. So those are the various institutions that I was calling home for the last couple of years. So when I first started out doing my graduate work, I was trying to figure out what exactly I was most interested in looking at from a research perspective, and I kept coming back to this idea of simulation-based education. And that really started because I think I was one of the early waves of residents in the postgraduate medical education system where simulation was being increasingly used for our postgraduate training, and there's been lots written about why that shift has happened in our pedagogical approaches to training and PGME. And one of the big questions was, how do we use simulation? Where do we use it? And what do we do with it to make it optimized for learning in the setting of surgical and medical education? And one of the things that was talked about a lot in the literature and that I personally was experiencing was this concept of fidelity. How realistic do we need to make simulation in order to really be beneficial for learning? And that's, I think, where an initial point of interest kind of came into this work. I wanted to look at this concept of fidelity. I wanted to better understand where it had come from, why people were talking about it, and why it was relevant, because it seemed like we didn't really have a great handle on it, but we also seemed to think that it was really important for simulation-based learning. And certainly in most conversations that you have with people who engage in simulation or who teach using simulation methods, fidelity often comes up as a topic, at least a conversation, if not as, in some circles, a dramatic approach to saying, well, we have to make sure that fidelity is maintained because otherwise we won't be able to get learning benefit, we won't be able to get transfer of learning from the simulation lab into the clinical setting. And so there was this pervasive idea, and I really didn't understand where it came from, and I thought we should probably understand that a little better. It turns out that there's been a lot of people who I think are probably a lot smarter than me who have done a lot of writing on this topic in the last few years. Peter Dykman, Jeff Norman, in a recent review that he published in Medical Education in 2012, Lawrence Grierson, Dan Hamstra, and their group have all written on this topic and have provided some important insights to show that the evidence base supporting this idea that we've always had that fidelity is correlated to learning outcomes really doesn't pan out. And so my interest in looking at the concept of cognitive load arose from trying to understand why it is that we keep finding in the literature that higher fidelity doesn't always translate into improved learning, and in particular, improved transfer of learning from the simulation setting into the clinical setting.
That's very helpful, and you raised a number of concepts in there that I'm going to ask you to elaborate on a little bit. For those who are familiar with the simulation literature, fidelity is a concept that's well known, and it's also, I think, one of those concepts that is defined in a variety of ways by different people. Mm-hmm. Were there particular aspects of fidelity that you were intrigued by or that you think were particularly important for guiding this work?
So, yeah, and that's a great question. So I think the first thing to say is that, as you've alluded to, we don't really have a consensus definition of what exactly fidelity is. And that's certainly been a source of debate in the literature. I think from my perspective, I had always thought of it in its simplest terms as associated with the concept of realism. So how realistic does a simulation be, or how much does it need to replicate elements of a clinical context or clinical environment or clinical task that we're trying to simulate, and how does that relate back to the learning outcomes? And as I kind of delved into that relatively naive definition a bit more, I realized that that stems from some theoretical premises on which a lot of our beliefs about fidelity are based. So Godden and Badley's work around context specificity is often cited as the landmark sort of psychological literature that we attribute to be the rationale for why simulation or fidelity or how realism should relatively increase transfer of learning. So this idea that if we can mimic a context, say I wanted to learn how to do a lumbar puncture, if I create all of the same kind of environmental conditions, task characteristics, and situational factors that might be related to performing a lumbar puncture in an emergency setting. If I do that in the simulation lab, I should be able to increase the transfer of learning from that situation. And by replicating all of those factors, when that student goes out into the emergency room and tries to do an LP for the first time on a real patient. And that was the crux of one of the theoretical concepts that I was trying to test in my dissertation that we try to get at a little bit in this study, which is around this idea of context specificity and its relevance to transfer of learning.
Right. And the aspect of context that you're playing with, as the title implies, is task complexity. And you already mentioned the idea of cognitive load. It seems self-referential to say that more complex tasks require higher cognitive load. Was there some basis from which you thought that one form or another would, in terms of degree of effort required, would yield better learning?
Yeah, so that also comes from the second theoretical framework that was used in this work, and that's around cognitive load theory. Some of the readership would be familiar with this concept. It's been talked about a fair amount in the last few years, both in the journal and in the broader medical education literature. So CLT is based around a concept that our human cognitive architecture has a limited capacity, the idea that our working memory can only hold so much information at a given point in time, and there's a point at which that working memory is exceeded, then there are going to be detrimental effects on learning. CLT also goes on to talk about various types of load that can be experienced by a learner during any given learning experience, intrinsic, extraneous, and train load in the original formulations or in the more recent formulations, simply talking about intrinsic versus extraneous load. But the fundamental crux of it is this idea that if you have this limited box of working memory, if your task requires more attentional capacity, working memory capacity, beyond which the learner doesn't have the capacity to deal with, then you're going to enter a state of overload. And that's where we play around in the title a little bit with that concept. When we increase the complexity of a learning environment, there's more information available for learning, but there's also increased information processing demands. Do those demands exceed working memory capacity for a novice learner? And is that potentially the reason why in these higher complex situations, learners struggle more and therefore may not derive the learning benefit that we would expect they would? The other important concept is the link between complexity and fidelity, because somebody might say, well, we were talking about fidelity a few minutes ago, and now we're talking about complexity. How does that link up? And so the assumption underlying the work is that as you increase the fidelity of a simulation environment, you're concomitantly increasing the complexity. And while that might not always be the case, it certainly was the case in the kind of things that we were manipulating in our setting. We were changing the fundamental nature of the task that was being done in many ways and ramping up the complexity of those tasks while also changing the level of realism or how closely it approximated factors or clinical setting, things that you would find in the clinical environment.
And to push that a little bit further, you put those ideas together and came up with quite an elegant experiment in terms of, if I remember correctly, randomizing people to learn in a simple task versus a more complex task. When you talk about ramping up the complexity, what sorts of things were you changing from one condition to another?
So there was a couple of broad facets that we manipulated. The first was around the patient characteristics. So we would change the anatomy that the learner would have to encounter. In the simple scenario, we had what we called the normal anatomy of the patient. So there was an easily palpable landmarks in the lumbar spine because they were tasked with performing a lumbar puncture. So the lumbar spine anatomy was relatively normal. The patient was skinny, whereas in the complex task, it was a geriatric patient who had a little bit of degenerative scoliosis, and the landmarks weren't easily palpable. The patient was obese, so there was a lot of factors relating to the kinesthetic feedback that you would get from the simulator and that you would use for judging where you would insert your needle and those sorts of things that were altered. We changed the environmental characteristics, the lighting, the level of noise, the amount of distraction that was in the environment. We also changed the nature of the task from a time perspective. Often when you have to do an LP in a clinical setting, you might be under a time crunch. Either you have to go see other patients or the patient might have some clinical issues going on that you need to do the procedure relatively expediently. And so we introduced a time pressure in the complex scenario that wasn't there in the simpler scenario. And we also changed the nature of supervision. So the supervisor who was monitoring and evaluating the learner as they were doing the task was relatively benign in the simpler task. And we got them to be a little bit more forceful and more demanding when they were in the more complex scenario. So trying to change a variety of different factors that might influence psychological demands, physical demands, as well as time demands for the learner.
Well, and when you did that, it's almost a manipulation check, but clearly the cognitive load measures that you were using indicated lower load or mental effort for the simple group compared to the complex group. What do you see as the key finding, though, that this work has led you towards?
Well, there's a couple of interesting things. The first is that it was good to see that we could demonstrate using our objective measures of cognitive load, both the subjective rating measures as well as the secondary task measures that we used in the study, that they truly did vary with our expected manipulations in load. So as you mentioned, it was a bit of a manipulation check, but also forms of validation for the manipulations that we had made to the environment. And we did clearly see during training that there was a significant difference between cognitive load in those who were training on the simpler simulation task versus those that were training on the complex task. The other part that was interesting is that when we started to look at some of the performance outcomes, we used a global rating scale as an RLP performance measure, but we also noted the number of sterility breaches that learners made. We started to see interesting changes there. In generally, those who were training on the simpler task consistently outperformed those who were training on the complex task during training, and then we let everybody go home for about 10 days and brought them back for a retention test. And again, those who trained on the simpler task outperformed those who were training on the complex task. And then we went to a transfer test, which was really our main point of interest. And that transfer test was specifically designed to mirror a lot of the contextual factors present in the complex task. And when we put them into this, what we call the hybrid simulation and very complex task, where they were dealing with a lot of the same challenging factors that learners who were training on the complex scenario had to deal with. We noted that a lot of, with the added challenge of going into a very, very challenging task that they didn't have any experience dealing with, the learners who started in the simple scenario actually performed much better with respect to maintaining sterility than those who trained on the more challenging task. Even though you would have expected that those learners would have been dealing with the higher cognitive load when they were transferring and they weren't used to a lot of the contextual factors. So the context specificity from a theoretical perspective would not have predicted their outperforming of the other learners.
So let me take you towards wrapping up this brief conversation about the data, because there's obviously a lot here that we won't have time to get to, but I'm wondering about the implications. You know, I suspect it's not as simple as saying learners should be given easy tasks because they'll do better on complex tasks afterwards. How do you resolve the issue of when and how to start building complexity in for trainees as they gain more experience?
Well, I guess what I could say is that the study gives us a couple of important considerations or ground rules that we should think about. The first is that we do need to think about not just what we want to be teaching and what the nature of the clinical information or skills that we want to be imparting to our learners is, but we also need to consider their level of training and what they can handle at any given point in time. So that's important. I think in the future, we're going to have to look for ways to be able to understand what cognitive load or cognitive demand is being placed on a learner in a given particular learning environment and make sure that we're not entering into that kind of state of overload, or if that is possible, that there are ways for us to simplify tasks and allow learners to be able to work up to whatever level of complexity is the target so that they're not being overwhelmed in the initial stages of learning in particular. The second would be, I think another piece that we didn't get a chance to talk about is that our learners were doing things actively to manage their cognitive load during the study. And that was an important piece that came out during our conversations with learners during our manipulation check. And I think it's important for us to think about what learners are doing in these environments, why they're doing it, and what the implications for learning are for them and for our instructional design. And so I think learners do things that as educators or as instructional designers, we may not be considering. And we need to understand the rationales and what they're doing and the goals that they're coming into a learning environment with so that we can understand the outcomes that we're going to be generating on the other side. So those would be two bits that I think are really important to think about.
Yeah, it's a very important point that the learners aren't necessarily doing what we intend them to do. And even with an experimental design like this, where you had a lot of control built into the exercise and fairly documented procedural tasks to be performed, we really don't have a lot of control over exactly what they do, do we?
No, not at all. But I think that's kind of the exciting part too, because we get to explore that a bit and understand what decisions they're making, why, and whether those are decisions that are in keeping with what we want them to be learning or getting out of the experience, and whether or not there needs to be some movement towards other considerations, or whether we can let them run free and actually they'll do a pretty good job managing it for themselves.
Right. Well, again, I'll direct our listeners to the paper itself so they can get some more of these insights in a more elaborated form. But it's an excellent piece of work, and congratulations on completing your PhD. I'm sure that's a big load off of you, pun intended.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to hear that your clinical training is proceeding well at the same time and coming near an end. I'll just finish by reminding our listeners that I've been speaking with Faisal Haji, who is the first author on a paper due out in the September 2016 issue of Medical Education entitled Thriver Overload: The Effect of Task Complexity on Novices' Simulation-Based Learning.
Great. Thank you so much, Kevin.